The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. Coming to you cordless, everybody, up to the satellite and into your bed, just where you want me, huh? It's 11:02 on the East Coast of the United States, 8:02 on the West Coast, 2 minutes after 2 p.m. in the afternoon in Sydney, Australia, and 10 p.m. at night, 10:02 p.m. here in Minneapolis, where I am not wearing a blonde wig this evening. I'm Jim Peters, and welcome to this edition of Jim Peters at Night. I think it's show number 44, I think. But here's the better news. I didn't talk about this last night. Actually, I forgot about it because of all the hullabaloo about Halloween. But yesterday was our three-month anniversary being on the air. So, and it's very prescient that we have on our guest today, our guest tonight, Murray Sabrin, was our guest on our very first show. He was our very first guest we ever had. So I'm kind of glad that he's back here. You probably noticed, if you watch us with any regularly whatsoever, which is the five of you in Australia, and I appreciate it. Thank you. there's a certain number of people that we have on at a regular basis. I try to have them on about every 6 weeks. There's Murray, who's on tonight, Jazz Shaw, David Strom, Jeff Myers, a regular here, a couple other people. We have them on about every, depending on their schedule, depending on what's going on. Like Strom's on tomorrow night because we got to talk about the all of the Israeli hatred that he's been writing about voluminously on hotair.com. And both him and Jazz, David is the associate editor there. Jazz Shaw is the weekend editor. And so those guys, they're both just tremendous writers, and their point of view is really, really impeccable, if you ask me. And on top of that, Jazz Shaw also writes about UFOs for a numerous number of publications, including Hot Air, and he's an expert on that. And we're going to talk about that a little later on the episode, the interview with Murray Sabrin we taped earlier this afternoon. I think you figured this out. There's a lot of people who live on the East Coast, and Murray lives in Florida, who don't want to do these interviews at 11:30 at night. I kind of don't blame them, so I try to accommodate everybody as best as we can. I do the interviews in the afternoon from my office, not from our studio here, so you can kind of see in the background, if you look, there's a whole lineup of pill bottles, because that's what happens when you have heart problems, ladies and germs. You got to take a bunch of pills. So at any rate, yes, today's our three-month anniversary. How's it going? It's going pretty well. Our numbers, considering the fact we've only done like 44, 45 shows, I'll check tomorrow night the actual number. Our numbers are pretty damn good. I mean, I think we crossed yesterday or today 700 followers on Rumble. You know, we've had several interviews on Rumble that have gotten several thousand views. The last one was Eddie Scary. It usually depends on how those people post to their followers. Some of these people have a lot of followers, so if they post the interview, and Eddie said very nice word things about us. That was very, very kind of him. We get a lot of views, especially after the fact. So that's been kind of cool. So it's so far so good. I'm starting to realize, and I was talking to a couple of people in the talk media industry. Talkers Magazine did an article about this show 2 weeks before we started, because we are apparently the very first talk show in America to take video phone calls. And speaking of which, while I'm on that subject, you see this thing down here? You can go to jimandnight.com/call and press a big blue button on the screen, and you will end up in our virtual, in the queue in our virtual studio. It's really simple. And you're asking, well, Jim, why do I have to go to a webpage? Because the whole thing's set up The button on that web page triggers the whole thing, so you don't have to download any special software, Zoom meeting, none of that crap. You just push the button, you go to a screen where you can check your camera and mic to make, get the crap out of your teeth and comb your hair and all this sort of shit, make sure you look good, and that when you hit the join button at the bottom, you're in the queue. It's simple. Now, last night, we did our Halloween spooktacular show, which I'm sure we'll do every year. I look ravishing as a blonde woman, don't you think? You got to go back and watch that. I have to say, I got a lot of really good comments about the episode. It went amazingly well, considering the fact we virtually had no agenda or rundown or anything. So it's like it was called the BS Spooktacular because we weren't going to talk about BS. Now, as it turned out, the conversation at the end did get kind of serious about issues. We had on Don Zorro. An information analyst for a covert government organization, which I can't name. We had on Tim Conaway, who's running for president. And he was very entertaining. He was very entertaining because maybe the best gag of the whole show was when Tim, you got to watch it. I think it's about halfway through, about the 30, 45 minute mark. Tim takes off his mask and he has makeup on underneath. That's really pretty funny. Thank you for going through the trouble, Tim. That was great. And David from San Francisco called in, longtime caller, even on my previous radio shows and podcasts. So that was very nice too. So at any rate, what have I learned during this 3 months? I'll tell you what I've learned. So I got sidetracked there. So I was talking about Talkers Magazine. Michael Harrison, the founder and publisher of Talkers Magazine, he has agreed to be on the show. He's going through some family issues right now, so it's not going to be anytime soon. But he told me he'll come on. That's great. He's a wonderful guy, extremely knowledgeable. He knows everybody and everything about the talk media business in the United States, both radio and television. And that magazine that he founded, he hosts the Talkers Convention every year in June, which is the annual convention for talk media in the United States. And I was very, very pleased because nobody knew me for shit, and I got an invitation. It's invitation only. You just can't sign up. I got an invitation this year, and I'm sure it was because of him. It was very nice of him, and I enjoyed myself immensely. But I'm talking to him, and I was telling him, you know, he's wondering, well, how is this different? And I'm starting to realize this is a completely different broadcasting medium. It's not podcasting. We're not, you know, we do the audio from the show is posted on Spreaker as a podcast. So we do have an audio podcast, you know, but it's all the audio from the show. And I don't know how many people are going to, I don't even check the stats, how many people are doing that, because my personal thing is that I think most people are still going to go to YouTube and Rumble, even if they just want to listen to it. You know, you hook your phone up to your car, you know, and of course you can't see the picture in your car, but you know, but you probably, whatever. But I did that almost as a legacy thing. I mean, podcasting has been very good to me, so I wanted to have an audio-only version of this. And also, we are live on the Spreaker app, too. If you download the Spreaker app and go to the live section, you can listen to the show right now. We are live on Spreaker. But other than that, it's like, this is not really a podcast. And also, it's not television either, and it's certainly not radio. I don't quite know what to make of it. I'm kind of feeling my way here, and I'm starting to kind of get my legs a little bit. But it's different from all of those things. Now, I told Michael, and I'm telling you this too, I'm coming up with a name for this. There's not even a name for this type of show. I'm calling it a vodcast, VODCAST, as in video on demand, even though it's live, even though there is that too. But right now, the vast majority of people watch this on playback, on demand. So I'm hoping more people watch live, especially when people start to, you know, realize that they can call in and we get a little bigger audience. We've had people do call in, like David called in last night, but we haven't got a lot of call-ins. And I think the one thing that I did not anticipate when we decided to do the video phone calls is how many people don't want their face on the screen. I think that's a lot of it, from what I can tell. I'm just kind of feeling this out. But yeah, a lot of you are trolling bastards. you love the anonymity, and you know, and on radio, of course, you know, no one sees you. You know, so you can grab a different name, go on to somebody completely different. But that said, too, and this is even in the instructions on the call-in page, you can, quote-unquote, mute your camera. You can call in and turn your camera off, and we make it really easy for you to do that. There's a drop-down for your camera. You can choose no video. The video's off. It's simple. So, you know, you control us, too, if you want. Excuse me. And, yeah, I mean, I'd rather have you troll me than not call at all. So, you know, you can call in. Anyway, thanks to the guys last night. Thanks to Conaway, Zorro, and David. Appreciate that. We had a lot of fun. It was a good time. The few people who saw the episode let me know today that they enjoyed it immensely. I'm going to try to see if we can do some sort of panel discussion. And, you know, David alluded to this. Those two guys, the other two guys, Zorro and Conaway, were on. For my previous employer, I did a weekly news podcast, and they were on the panel most of the time. They were the regulars, and we had a really good time doing that. And it was kind of sad that it stopped, but maybe we can recreate that here. I don't know if we can do that even every other week, but maybe once a month or something like that. I don't know. We'll figure that out. But we had a really good time. So thanks to those guys. Now, all right, I was talking about just calling in. The other thing I want to point out here, you see this? If you don't want to call in, you can leave me a text or a voicemail at that number, 408-458-5088. You got that? You will remember this in your sleep. 408-458-5088. You can leave us a text at that message at that number, and you can leave us a 30-second voicemail. And people are using. I'm getting these things. I'm trying to figure out. We don't get a lot of voicemails. We do get a few. We do get a reasonable number of texts. I'm trying to figure out how to put the voicemails on the air. There's no picture, of course, and just another thing for me to figure out. But yeah, so you can, you know, after the fact. Now, I don't check any of this stuff on while the show is running, and I get complaints. I've gotten complaints about this. I do not check the chat in any of the venues, the platforms we're on, especially the two major ones are YouTube and Rumble. I don't check the chat while the show is going. I don't. I know people are saying, you should do, I don't give a fuck what you think, because it's boring watching people read the chat scroll. It's boring. Got that? Now, you can think, well, I'm talking right now. This is boring, too. Yeah, but there's something about it. You know, I mean, and I'm not even giving a talent. I'm not talking about any talent I may or may not have. I'm talking to the camera, and there's something, you know, I'm addressing you. That's you in bed watching this with your phone and the covers over your head. Got that? So, you know, you don't want to be here sitting talking about the chat scroll. I know there's people who do it and kind of do it successfully. There's a guy on Rumble. His name is Renicky, I think it is. He has a really good show. And the real amazing thing is he's broadcasting out of a tiny little town west of the Twin Cities Metro. He's very close to here. I could go visit him, you know. But I don't know if I'm going to do that. I could stalk him, I suppose, too. But anyway, I see a lot of these shows. People do these shows. Most of them are, I'll be blunt, most of them are terrible, absolutely terrible from any professional standpoint. But he's running a really good show. And this is another thing that fascinates me. Okay, so I'll tell you. The interview with Murray Sabrin coming up is 49 minutes long, right? I think that's long. I do. Now, we talked about a whole bunch of stuff. We talked about the current economic situation, which is the reason I wanted him on. Because right now there are people who are saying, oh, you know, the economy is really great. Well, if the economy is so fucking great, how come the cost of my frozen pizza went up 50% in a month? You know? Well, it isn't. And Murray talks about this. The economy actually isn't that great, regardless of what the Biden administration would like to tell you. And then we got into talking about the Israeli-Hamas conflict, which is... Mr. Sabrin is Jewish, but like he said, that's the problem is, you know, just to be perfectly straight up, there's nothing Israel can do right now and not look bad. Hamas has put them in a terrible situation. They either bomb the crap out of Gaza and no one will be able to return, or they're going to be stuck with a bill for rebuilding the place, which is going to be enormous, or if they cease fire, Hamas has just said today, they released a statement today saying, we're going to bomb Israel out of existence. That's their goal. So what do? You know? Well, I mean, you got to defend yourself. So I suppose, you know, out of all the terrible choices, they've chosen the best one, and that is to bomb Hamas back. But it's really there, you know, and so you have all these people who are protesting all these college campuses, and we're going to talk to David Strump about that tomorrow. He has a lot of really poignant thoughts on that, for lack of a better term. But, so anyway, my point was that the interview with Murray is about 15 minutes long. So I'm going to talk in a few minutes here. Elon Musk was on with Joe Rogan again. Now, Joe Rogan is the giant gorilla in the podcasting business, and he also does video of his show. And that's the other thing, too. So, I mean, it's a really, really fine point. He does video for his podcast. This is not a podcast. Because it's live, this is a live show. So it is hard to reconcile that sort of stuff. Rogan's show is not live. He tapes it. It's usually 2 to 2.5 to 3 hours long. He's famous for doing 2.5 hour interviews, and the interview he did with Elon Musk is 2.5 hours. This show is usually 90 minutes, sometimes 90. We've done 1 hour 45 on a couple occasions. If people start calling, I blocked off up to 2 hours. Now, we can't go past 2 hours because on most and maybe even all of the 7 platforms, 8 platforms we broadcast on, we can't go over for 2 hours. But I'm just astonished and really fascinated by the fact that you people, that would be the public, the viewing public, that you'll watch Rogan talk to Elon Musk for 2.5 hours. I was joking with somebody. I couldn't make love to Britney Spears for 2 hours. It's like, I'm bored. Turn on Fox News. Let's watch TV. You know, it's, I can't do that. It's just like, I don't know. I burn out, you know? And the other weird thing is I noticed when we were podcasting, when I started the podcasting stuff 3-4 years ago, I'm looking at the other podcasts and I noticed like Dan Bongino does a podcast separate from his radio show. They're not the same. And his podcasts were almost exactly an hour. But the thing is, they were over a little bit. It was like 59 minutes, 102, 62 minutes. And I'm thinking, well, that's really weird. Is it some contractual thing that they have? And after you start to do this for a while, you realize, no, there's a rhythm to it, and the timings almost always come out the same. And so I've noticed when we have a guest on, usually these shows are almost exactly 90 minutes. You know, like 3-4 minutes either way. Usually, not always. If we get callers, and this is a reason I blocked off the 2 hour limit, I would like to fill the last half hour with callers. So then the show might be 2 hours. And like I said, we've had shows where we've had callers. Now I think we've done 2 shows that have been about 1 hour 45. But it's just astonishing how you end up kind of in a rhythm, and the show, and you just kind of know when to stop. And this is one of the beautiful things about this versus radio broadcasting, because here's the 3 primary differences between broadcasting on the radio and podcasting. Number one, on the radio, you have to, what's called hit post, which means there's certain timings you have to, because of commercial breaks, and especially in syndication, you absolutely have to make. There's soft breaks and hard breaks. The hard breaks, if you don't make the hard break, you'll just get cut off. So there's that. Number two is that, unlike radio broadcasting, almost everybody who listens to a podcast listens to from the beginning first. Radio is now designed, it wasn't years ago, television is now like this, and even if you watch Fox News, most of the things on Fox News or even any of the news channels are designed as quote unquote shows. So they're usually an hour long, and they're basically they are timed to accommodate people who tune in at the beginning, or even tape it, you know, at the beginning and watch the whole hour. Now it's interesting because since the Israeli war conflict started, Fox News has kind of gone into now what I call radio mode, which is now they're broadcasting constantly. and they've kind of, in many instances, they've ignored the show posts or the hour posts, and they're assuming people are tuning in and out. And that's what radio has become in America now. It's become, although, you know, most standard syndicated radio shows, conservative radio shows, and I hate to say this, there really aren't any liberal radio shows. There aren't. Liberal radio, people try it, and I know there's a couple, Tom Hartman, there's a couple other people who do liberal talk radio, but it is not successful. As a general rule, the public is not interested. And this is really weird, because the liberals have been bitching about conservative talk radio like for 30 years since Rush Limbaugh started, but they can't seem to come up with a viable product. People are not interested. So it's pretty much all conservative. The reason it's all conservative radio is because that's all the public's interested in listening to. I know that's weird, but it's true. But, you know, these shows are, as a standard, are 3 hours long. You listen to Dana Lash in the afternoon, you're not expected to listen to the entire 3 hours. Now, the weird thing is, Limbaugh was so compelling that people actually did. People listened to the entire 3-hour show. The other thing I'll cue you into, which you might find really interesting, which is like master the obvious shit, but it needs pointing out, and that is, especially, I check the timings, and they're all, the syndicators put out what's called show clocks, which shows exactly where the commercials are going and are going to go. You take Dana Lash, who's on from noon to 3 Eastern Time, syndicated all across the country, out of San Antonio, if I'm right. Of the 3 hours she's on the air, she's actually only talking about an hour, 35 minutes. Really, it's about half of the show. Now, her show is really successful. It has a couple more minutes of commercials, that sort of shit. But your radio station has to put in the news and all that sort of stuff. So by the time you get an hour of broadcasting, is actually only about 35 minutes. So that's another thing you don't have to deal with podcasting either. You know, and what's the third thing? Let me think. There's three things. And now I can't think of the third one. And that's probably good, because I'm just going on forever. So I'm going to bring up something here. Before we go to the interview with Murray, I want to talk about something. I want to talk about that interview that Joe Rogan did with Elon Musk, because it was really, really telling. Elon Musk says he bought Twitter because he was coming to the conclusion that it's what he called zombie apocalypse thinking. It was so left-wing that he came to the conclusion, and it was so influential, he came to the conclusion that if it didn't stop, it was basically going to be the end of civilization. He actually said that. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but if I'm right, he actually used that term. He compared it to the district in San Francisco where the Twitter headquarters is. Now, Twitter is now called, I guess, X, but... you know, whatever. I'm going to use the word Twitter because you know what I'm talking about. He said that the immediate area in San Francisco around the Twitter headquarters has so fallen into calamity based on homelessness and drug use and all this. And he said, well, the only thing that can happen is that that Twitter, as the way it was going to basically spread this false ideology, non-working ideology all over the United States. He said it was going to be the beginning of the end of civilization as we know it. Now, that sounds a little dramatic, and even he said that too, but he's got a point. I mean, he's got a really point. I'm a former liberal, red-blooded liberal, former liberal. My mother, you know, she's been on the show. She's 99 years old. She wonders what happened to me. My wife, who's 34 years, wonders what happened to me. She married a liberal man, and then I turned into this conservative thing that she doesn't understand at all. But the reason I did is because I think you have to come to terms with the fact that liberal ideology simply doesn't work. I'm a very pragmatic person, you can talk about, you know, I have friends who go on about democratic socialism, all this stuff. None of that crap actually works. It's been tried and tried and tried. During an interview with Murray, you'll hear in a few minutes, we talk a little about socialism and communism because Murray is an immigrant. I'm a first-generation American. My parents are immigrants, and I talk about the fact, and I know it sounds like a joke, because yes, people actually do live in Albania, but my family in Albania was actually quite well-to-do, and the communist government took everything away from them. And, okay, so, you know, if you're a communist, you can say, well, that's fair, but the problem on a bigger scale is that the government doesn't actually produce anything. And Murray will talk about this at length. You know, that's the you know, I told him, I wanted him to illuminate on this, because he's really understands this way more than I do and you do. But my point to him was that, and this has been my point for the longest time, this is the reason I even started having Murray on these shows. There's this biggest single misnomer of the public, and that would be you, about how capitalist economy works, is everyone assumes there's a static pile of money, and that, you know, a pie, and that if you get more of it, that means somewhere else gets less by the same amount, that the pie's just cut a different way. And that's completely wrong. That's not the way it works. The fact of the matter is, and he brings this up, and that is, if you're training fairly, you know, if you have a fair trade, you know, let's say you make a product. I don't know. Let's say earrings. You make earrings. You sell them on Etsy, right? So somebody buys your earrings. Well, they're buying your earrings with the money that they made doing something else. And it's a win-win situation. No one loses in that scenario. But a lot of people think that if you make more money, someone else is losing the same amount. And that's just false. I do want to point out that something that Murray did not get around to talking about, because everyone wonders this. Well, how does capitalism actually create money? Now, we know it creates wealth. That's a, you know, but wealth is like, is a personal thing to you. Money is money in the system, and capitalism actually does create money. Well, there's two ways. There's an oblique way, and then simply by you doing something productive, you create money. That's all there is to it. Let's say if you didn't exist, you know, you got, you know, zapped out of existence, you know, there'd be a giant hole there that would not be creating what you're creating. So by going to work, by actually producing something, you are actually creating money. But the real technical way it's done is through banks. So banks, the primary function of a bank is not to hold your savings account or your certificate of deposit. It's to make loans. And so what happens is the bank, and by charter, this is where banks have to be licensed and highly regulated, banks are allowed to loan out way more money than they actually have on hand. Why? Because in the vast majority of instances, both individuals and corporations pay the money back. So the bank, you know, gives you a loan. And let's say technically they don't have that money on hand. They don't, but they give you a loan anyway, you know, for your car, and you make the payments on your car, and 5 years later you pay that loan back with interest. The interest is the amount, is their profit. But the money, the principal, is actually created through basically like a trick of accounting. That money did not exist before. So now the bank takes that money back in, which it technically had on its books, but not really. They did not have that money in the vault, and now they do. And I don't know if you can get this, but that's where money in the actual chain of capitalism is actually created. The money's literally created when banks make loans. And, of course, we have an enormous number of loans in this country, including, you know, credit card, real estate, you know, it's like that, and that's... So that's why capitalism works. There is no lose-lose scenario in capitalism, whereas in socialism and communism, there's a definite lose-lose, because the government cannot produce anything. So if the government takes over the means of production, they will fuck it up. It's as simple as that. It always happens. It's happened for time immemorial. That's been happening. So anyway, I kind of got off track here because I was talking about Elon Musk. So Musk said he bought Twitter because he said he wanted to save humanity from right-wing ideology. The other thing he said, which I thought was really, really interesting too, and this is, I couldn't have put this better. It's obvious to me. It's like master, once again, master of the obvious crap once again. But he said, the problem with the media is they think Twitter is real. And what he means is they think that's real life. And nothing could be further from the truth. And the problem is they do think that. We have a whole class of people. He was talking about this. And even, who was I listening to earlier today? We have a whole class of people now who live online. They live their entire lives online. They're not producing anything. Or actually, I shouldn't say that. They're producing content for Twitter and Facebook that they can resell. And they're now, those companies make a fortune off the shit that you write for them for free. Yeah, and I'm not one of them. You know, now I have a very interesting relationship with all this. In the 1990s, this is going back 25 years ago, pre what was called Web 1.0, I ran one of the largest social communities on the internet. I'm not going to tell you the name of it. I'm not, but I did. And the interesting thing, I ran it for 5 years. And with the collapse of Web 1.0, when the stock market crashed in March 2001, our service went out of business. But during that 5 year period, I saw everything that's happened now in social media condensed in a smaller time frame. And the one thing that we didn't have then is we didn't have the technical controls to stop a lot of this stuff. So I remember I hired a programmer when we first started this thing. This is like in 1995. And, you know, I don't know if you know this, there's very, in early 1995, there was about 400 or 500 commercial websites on the internet. This service I ran was one of the very first commercial websites on the internet. And I hired a programmer. And at that time, I don't know if you know anything about programming. But right now, the prominent programming languages used on the internet are PHP, and Jesus Christ, what's the one that that Google uses? Oh shit, now I can't even remember. It's basically an offshoot of PHP. But in 1995, it was a language called Perl, because Perl already existed and nobody knew anything about the internet. So and if I'm right, Tim Berners-Lee invented the web in 1987, I think it was. So you didn't, and then it was, and he did. It was the Department of Defense issued the .com address for commercial, I think, in 92. So by 95, there are about 400 or 500 commercial websites on the internet. And I still remember I hired this programmer, and he said, well, you know, and his experience and the reason he knew all this stuff is because he had dealt with what we call bulletin board networks, BBSs. And the way that worked is, you had to call in with a modem to every one of them individually. They each had a telephone number, and you called in with your modem, and the modem translated the interface onto your computer. So you had, your internal email, and you had your forums and all that sort of stuff, discussion boards, and you could chat rooms, and you could talk, and that's the way that worked. But the problem is there was no way at that time to blend those things together seamlessly. You had to call in separately to every single one. The biggest one ended up being CompuServe, which I don't think actually exists anymore, if I'm right. And I was a member of CompuServe. So I hired this guy. And his experience was entirely on bulletin board systems. It was the same language. It was still going to work. And I hired him, and I'm telling him about what we want to do. And I don't know, at some point he said, well, you know, I've never worked on any one of these BBS systems that hasn't socially collapsed. He said they all seem to go to hell at some point. And, you know, I'm so freaking arrogant. I said, well, you know, we can do this differently, you know. It's the same thing as, like, my friends saying, oh, the democratic socialism is going to be different. No, it's not. No, and I had the same stupidity. We can do this different. We can do this different. We can beat this. He said, no, you won't. He knew. He said he was so experienced at this and saw this so often. He said, "No, you're not going to beat it." And he was right. We didn't. We were out of business in 5 years. You know, even though we had thousands of people online on the service. So I'm telling you this because, yeah, the thing is, there's a precedent for this stuff. And he's right. I saw a whole bunch of people 25 years ago, even then, living online, You know, and maybe I was one of them even. If, you know, I have no social media presence whatsoever other than the show. The show's all over the place, but I don't post at all, not the least bit. Matter of fact, my attitude toward this is that if you want to know what I think, watch the show. I'm not going to post on Twitter. I'm not going to screw you, you know. And people's lives are going down the toilet because of this, because they're living online. And also, God, don't we have a wonderful group of people who know how to socially interact? No, we don't. They don't know how. So anyway, yeah, I thought that was really interesting that he said that. There's, you know, that Twitter is not real. That's what he said. You know, and he's right, it isn't. Now, we got another thing, too, and I got to talk about this for a second because I got to finish the whole thing out because it's all a big circle. TikTok, you know, there's the vast majority of the people on TikTok are pro-Hamas. You would think, and maybe they are, but you don't really know because the Chinese freaking government runs TikTok. I mean, this is a, you know, I could sit here and tell you about the fact you shouldn't give your information to Facebook because all they're going to do is make $1 million off of you. And that's true. They are. But the thing is, in some ways, other than that, it's benign. TikTok, it's not a matter of them, you know, making money off of you. They're literally stealing your information. There are vast databases in China of all the people in the U.S. who use this thing. And then they prop, you know, young people on TikTok, they prop them up and make them look like it's all viral and all sort of shit. Let me tell you another thing, too. This is important. You know, all this stuff about people going viral, you know, like on, do you remember MySpace? Remember that? How there were several big name musical artists that broke on MySpace. It still happens on Facebook occasionally, all this stuff. That's bullshit. Almost all of those people were planted by PR people. Almost all of it. You've been manipulated. That's the thing. And I know this because I worked in the music business for a while. That's the reason I know. There's like everything that's viral, the vast majority of it actually isn't. Somebody somewhere has figured out a way to make it popular by manipulating data. That's all there is to it. And the thing is that Twitter and TikTok is doing this wholesale. You know, you go on TikTok, you'll find all sorts of people talking about all sorts of shit, and a lot of them aren't real. They're getting paid by the Chinese government to post this crap. And so if you get on TikTok, you get the impression the vast majority of the country is pro-Hamas, and that's not true. The vast majority, poll after poll down in the last 3-4 weeks, the vast majority of TikTok, of people in the United States, are pro-Israel. But you never get that impression if you go on TikTok. And then, of course, then your kids are on TikTok, and they think, oh my God, everybody's pro-Hamas, maybe I should be too. Yeah, so you see how it works? And then China takes over the United States without firing a shot. It's like we're not even going to know it when they actually control most of the country, most of our economy. We won't even notice the difference. It's terrible. And the fact that this is allowed to happen, you know, what was somebody talking about the fact, you know, that the Biden administration has so been concerned about quote unquote misinformation, but TikTok, although we'll just let that slide. I don't know if that's because people are getting paid off by TikTok. I know that their lobbying presence in Washington, they're spending almost twice as much money this year, or more than they spent the previous year. They're obviously out to influence the election, you know, and it's pretty obvious they want Biden to win because they can push Biden around. If Trump wins, you know, they know they're screwed. So, yeah, all right, so there, that's my story, and I'm sticking to that. We're going to run the interview with Murray now, and I talked way too much, and so because of that, we might not do much at the end. So I did have something kind of planned for it, but we'd probably wait till tomorrow. So at any rate, here we go. Here's Murray Sabrin on Jim Peters Tonight. Joining us from his home in Naples, Florida, the economist extraordinaire, our fabled guest, Murray Sabrin. Hi, Murray. How you doing?
Hi, Jim. It's great to be with you again.
Hey, I want to point something out. Today's the today is the 3-month anniversary of our show, and you were our very first guest. So it's particularly appreciative that we should have you
okay,
today.
Okay, where's the cake? Yeah, cake
anniversary. You can't eat that, man. We're both diabetic. What are you talking about?
No, I'm not diabetic.
I'm not either. Yeah. Oh, my God. So, Murray, the reason I wanted to have you on today is because I keep hearing in the press, this is what I hear, the economic numbers are really strong. Then I hear other people say the surface numbers are really strong, but the underlying numbers are absolute crap. What's the truth?
Well, again, the economy is always a mixed bag. No matter what the state of the economy is overall, there are companies that are doing great. There are people that are making money hand over fist because they're in business. Their businesses are doing well. They're making overtime in certain areas. So I don't like to look at the economy from a top-down approach, even though that's the way most people look at it. But we know bankruptcies are going up. We know it's getting harder for people to buy homes and cars. Car prices are off the scale.
Oh, before you go on there, I got to ask you about this. So the number I've heard is that home prices have essentially, for the same amount of real estate you're buying, have essentially doubled in the last 3 years. Is that true? Yeah,
I know that I just read the median price of a home in the United States, which is half price, 50% of prices above that, 50% below, is just under $400,000, which is a mind-numbing number. But there are communities like Southwest Florida where that number is probably double prices have just skyrocketed in this area. People are coming in from all over the country. People love the climate down here, even though we are in a hurricane area. But fortunately, as they say, knock on wood, we haven't had any hurricanes this year, and hurricane season is practically over. So although we had a bad one last year, people are still coming here. However, there was something in the local paper this week which kind of caught my eye. According to the reporter who wrote the piece, is that people are leaving Florida because of homeowners insurance is skyrocketing. What? Why? Because of the higher rates due to the hurricanes and other phenomena that are occurring in the state. So again, people are leaving the state for personal reasons, for health reasons. They want to be closer to their children with where they think they will be better health care. But people are coming in droves. I mean, all you have to do is look at the DMV licensing numbers, and people are moving in at the rate of, I think I heard either 2,000 or 10,000 people are coming a day to Florida. And we see this in terms of real estate development. Condos are going up. Single-family house developments are coming up. Independent living facilities. So there is a building boom going on in the state of Florida right now, as there is in other states that have low taxes, good weather, good business climate, and people are leaving the proverbial high tax states like New York, New Jersey, Illinois, California. They're moving to low tax states or no income tax states like Tennessee, Nevada, Florida. Maybe some people who love the cold weather are going to New Hampshire. I just saw a map of the United States showing states that have no income tax. And I think that's going to be spreading because I think governors realize that in order for their economies to be better than their neighbors or other parts of the country, they have to do something with the tax burden. And when you're living in a state like I used to live in, New Jersey, where you have a high income tax, a high property taxes, probably high sales tax, unless there's some compelling reason for you to be there, retirees are moving. And we know that a lot of retired members of the New Jersey state legislature have moved to Florida. So although they caused the problem with high taxes, they're getting the hell out of Dodge.
They get out. Yeah. We'll cause a problem and then we'll leave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is really interesting, Murray. This goes under the radar. Here in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, where I'm sitting, we have either the second or the third highest state income taxes in the nation. I can't remember, and I think it maybe varies a little bit depending on how you measure it, but they're very high. They're even higher than like places like Illinois. But the weird thing is there is the kind of the assumption or presumption here in Minnesota that we still kind of had if we have a liberal government, but still relatively functional, you know what I mean? And there is The people seem to think they get their money's worth for their taxes, which is the reason we haven't seen a large exodus. Matter of fact, like you said, my neighborhood, there's every freaking corner, there's a 40-story apartment building going up. It's unbelievable. And especially considering the fact the weather here is terrible. I mean, it snowed 2 days ago. You know, I mean, this is crazy shit. But still, people, I don't know if they I don't know if they move here, but they certainly don't leave. You know, I don't know. I'm just bringing that has really nothing to do with the discussion, but I find it kind of fascinating because if I didn't have to stay here, I wouldn't.
Well, that's the whole point. It's all these decisions are very personal. And for us, it was really a no-brainer to leave New Jersey after I retired 3 years ago. We moved down here 2.5 years ago because I just was tired of the cold weather. I was tired of the high taxes, for which we get very little for. And so I said, where can we go that would be more compatible with what our needs are now that we're both retired? And I said, let's look at Florida. So we came down here just before the pandemic in January of 2020, and we scouted the area and moved to Fort Myers initially, but that didn't work out. So we're now in Naples, and it's been a wonderful move. In fact, it's exactly a year ago that we moved here at the end of October of 2022. And I couldn't be happier because here it is, November 1st, and the temperature right now, Jim, is 83 degrees. So I'm not complaining one bit. And in the morning, it was 68 degrees.
I could swear at you, Mary. Yeah. It's 37 here right now.
What's the temperature?
37.
Yeah. I don't have close to that weather anymore. So
no, you don't.
So I have to stay below North Carolina and South Carolina because we gave away our winter clothes. But I guess we still could make do with with the clothes that we do have, you just layer in. But again, I think Florida is one of the most attractive places in the country. It's a very business-friendly climate, which for a lot of entrepreneurs, that's a big help. And we know a lot of hedge fund managers have left Chicago because of the crime and all the dysfunctional things going on in Chicago. People have left New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, which is another high state. And all these blue states are making it very difficult for people to retire in because of the high taxes. And then the question is the quality of life. I mean, I've seen pictures of New York City recently with the migrant crisis. And it's not very attractive, to say the least, when you have people sleeping on the streets of high rent areas in Midtown and other places, Brooklyn and Queens and what have you. And the city is hemorrhaging money to take care of all of these migrants. And this is another example of why you need to have a rational immigration policy so people can come to America like we did in 1949, but do it in a way that doesn't put a burden on any of the taxpayers here.
Murray, I read your Substack newsletter, which you publish like a couple times a week, and we will push that on people. Is it murraysabrin.substack.com?
That's it, Jim. Yeah.
I got a quote I want to pull out. I want to talk about something here. And I was not going to skip ahead here, but you just brought it up. You had a thing on your Substack about a week or 2 weeks ago where you were talking about here's a thought exercise you had. What if 3 busloads of tourists from England – now, and I should point out here, you and I haven't talked since the war in Israel started. So, right. Your thought exercise. What if 3 busloads of tourists from England, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain and a bus full of 45 elementary school children was hijacked in either Washington, D.C., Wyoming, New York City, California, Florida, or any other popular destination vacation? Who's responsible for the safe return of the tourists? Which I thought that was a really interesting question, because then you go on to ask, first of all, like, who is responsible? But secondly, well, hold it. Let me pull that up again. I'll actually use your words here. It was like, oh, yeah, okay, so who pays for the aid, you know, who's actually paying for the $100 billion aid package that Biden wants to send to both Ukraine and Israel? And is it flawed that he's trying to bundle the two together?
Yeah, this is, I think, the essence of what a nation state local law enforcement is all about. I mean, when... Here in in Southwest Florida. Who's responsible for the well-being? It's the town police, the city police. It's the county sheriff and the state police that are responsible for law and order here in Florida. And so it would seem that every state would have that responsibility, local and state, and occasionally national. That would be the FBI and other agencies that are involved in law enforcement. So if tourists come over, would we allow the military or law enforcement agencies from other countries to come into the United States to make sure that their citizens are kept safe? No, we wouldn't do that. I don't think we would do that. It's law and order is a local responsibility. Having said that, what's the United States response to all the hostages that are in Gaza? I just read that there are several hundred still in Gaza. Yeah. And this is a problem when the Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, is going into Gaza and basically leveling the place. And so what's going to happen to these poor hostages? Are they going to be killed or maimed during the hostilities? Or will something good come about with Hamas saying, to build goodwill, they're going to release the hostages? So this is a horrible, horrible situation, to say the least. And it's another example of our muscular foreign policy called interventionism, which tries to solve the world's problems with U.S. aid and occasionally U.S. military, like we saw in the Korean Peninsula, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. And it hasn't worked out too well because we haven't won a war since World War II, having spent trillions and trillions of dollars on these military adventures. And the rationale that they're giving us for aid to Ukraine is if Putin is not stopping Ukraine, he's going to go all over Europe, which is what we heard in the 1960s with Johnson in Vietnam, that if we don't stop the communists in Vietnam, they're going to take over Southeast Asia. And before you know it, they'll be invading Hawaii and the West Coast.
And you brought up in one of your Substack pieces about the fact that we essentially busted a promise to Russia that we wouldn't try to put any of the countries surrounding it in NATO. And, and you're right. So in some of that onus is on us, because you're right, absolutely right about that.
Well, remember what happened 61 years ago, October 1962, when the Kennedy administration found out that there were Russian Soviet missiles in Cuba. We nearly had World War III. And fortunately, level heads prevailed. There were back channel negotiations. The missiles were withdrawn. Kennedy withdrew the missiles in Turkey that were aimed at the Soviet Union. And that defused that situation. However, a year later, Kennedy was assassinated. And a year after that, Khrushchev was ousted. So it seems that the military industrial complex in both Russia and and America did not like the peace that broke out between the United States and the Soviet Union. And this shows you how powerful the military-industrial complex is, which, of course, President Eisenhower warned us about in his farewell address.
Yes, a general, a military general said this. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know? I mean, there could not be more onus or, what's the word I'm looking for? The fact that he did this is really amazing. That he made the warning about that, you know.
And his original statement was, "It's the military industrial congressional complex," and he was told to take out congressional because in the last couple of weeks of his administration, he wanted some bills passed and he didn't want to criticize the Congress, so he took out congressional complex. So it's the military-industrial congressional complex. That's
I didn't know that, Murray. That's actually
I just found
cool.
that out myself as well from a geopolitical military strategist who said that Eisenhower was told to take out the congressional part of the military-industrial complex. So again, the problem we have, Jim, is not that we have too little military spending; we have too much military spending. We're stretched all over the world. And this is harming the U.S. economy. It's putting huge debt burdens on the American people because it depends on how you analyze the federal budget. All that $100 billion, $106 billion that Biden wants for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and border security, all that money has to be borrowed. That's extra spending. We're running a huge deficit now. So all that money will have to be borrowed. at 5% interest today, which is what interest rates are today, depending on where you are in terms of maturity. And so that will be a perpetual debt burden on the American people, because every year interest will be, have to be paid on that $106 billion if all of it goes through and Biden signs it. But he's already made the noises that he won't sign a separate Israeli aid package. He wants Ukraine and Israel bundled together. So he's playing politics with this whole thing.
Yeah.
And we'll see what happens. But right now, as I pointed out in my latest Substack column, Jim, that people have to come to the peace table. Hamas and Hezbollah and Israel have to come to the peace table. Unfortunately, Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran want to wipe Israel off the map. And so that's not a very good negotiating starting point.
No, it isn't. No, not at all.
So that's going to be very difficult. And that's why the United States should really exert some leverage on Israel if they really want to have peace in the Mideast. Just as Eisenhower in 1956 put leverage on Israel, England, and France when they got involved with the war with Egypt. And Eisenhower told them to withdraw because they were going to close the Suez Canal, I think, or they already had closed the canal, and Eisenhower got upset about that. So the United States can use its position because it's supplying so much military aid to Israel, saying, listen, get to the peace table, iron out your differences. But unfortunately, Israel is now leveling Gaza. They're basically, from what we've been seeing, they're bombing virtually all the buildings that are in northern Gaza. And if this continues, Gaza will be a wasteland. And then the problem with Israel will have, well, they'll have an enormous humanitarian crisis at their doorstep. They'll have, I think, tremendous opposition from the rest of the world, or for a good portion of the world. And then Israel will be isolated politically. And so this is a dangerous position that Israel places itself in. And the question is, what is the end game here? And if the end game is to wipe out Gaza as a area for the Palestinians to live in, then you have 2 million people who are basically nomads. Where are they going to live? What kind of economy will they have? What type of health will they have? What type of diseases will come about? And you couldn't ask for a worse situation for 2 million people in any part of the world.
Well, Israel seems to be backed in a corner. It's like there's nothing they can do here that's kind of good. I mean, you know, if they don't do anything, they're just going to end up with getting bombed again. I want to get back to one thing you said about like the 1960s. So obviously there was a lot of student protesting in the 1960s about the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And history seems to regard the student's position as correct. And like you said, there was no domino effect. 55,000 people essentially lost their lives for nothing. Nothing was really accomplished. It was all bullshit. And now we have very literal anti-Semitism on campus. And it seems to me that's the exact opposite of what it was 50, 60 years ago. Now we have young people, they're idiots. That's what I think personally. I mean, myself. But do you have any thoughts on this? Or I'm astonished.
Yeah. Well, again, I wrote this in my Substack yesterday that I was never a big fan of having, quote, a Jewish state, even though I'm Jewish and a son of Holocaust survivors. And as I write, my father told me that he didn't want to go to Israel or Palestine after World War II, because Israel wasn't formed until 1948, because he spent 5 years of his life defending himself in World War II and with two young children, my older brother and me, in 1947, 48. He didn't want to go in another area where there was conflict. And so they decided to come to America in August of 1949. And so I never felt comfortable, even growing up, saying there should be a Jewish state, because after all, the United States is not considered a, quote, a Christian nation. It's considered basically a secular nation with a majority of the population Christians.
Yeah.
And then you have all these other religious groups and ethnic groups in the country, racial groups. And so we have a very unique situation in the world. We have a very, quote, the melting pot. We have the proverbial melting pot. And so I was never a big fan of having, quote, a Jewish state in a hostile region, because there is there was a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment in the Mideast. And then when Israel became a state, and that's when you had the war in 1948, 56, 67, 73, and you've had skirmishes ever since then, and peace has never been able to occur in the 75-year history of Israel in terms of a long-lasting peace. And so because Israel is, quote, the Jewish state, any criticism of Israel is considered anti-Semitic, which I think is absurd. I mean, Israelis who criticize the Netanyahu government, are they anti-Semitic because they're criticizing the him? Or if you criticize right. Biden, are you anti-Christian because he's an Irish Catholic? No, you have to look at policy as opposed to the ethnicity or the religious component of a leader.
So, and Murray, do you think these students are doing that? Are they making the difference between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism?
No, I think that's the problem. That's the problem. I think they equate Judaism with Zionism, and obviously they're related. There's no question about it, because Zionism was founded by Theodor Herzl in the 19th century because of the anti-Semitism in Europe and Russia, and want to have a homeland for Jews so they could live together in peace. Unfortunately, it hasn't worked out that way, because the place that they chose was not hospitable to Jews living in peace in their own state. So they've been, and I did some research about this, not having studied this extensively, that there could have been places in Argentina, other parts of South America, where Jews would have been welcome in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. I remember reading a while ago, somebody suggested that Jews should have moved to Utah, open spaces, got a nice climate, and that would have been a wonderful place for Jews to go from around the world to settle in a very peaceful environment. But now that we have the situation in the Mideast, which has been percolating, to say as an understatement, for 75 years, how does Israel live in peace with its neighbors, given that there are claims on the land that the Palestinians have and it hasn't been resolved? So my solution, which I wrote on my Substack, is that there should be an international tribunal of impeccable jurists from around the world getting together and listening to the claims people make about their land, because some of them may have actual deeds to the land that they feel was taken, confiscated by the Israeli government over the years. And so they could do that. And the West Bank, again, that was captured in the 67 war. That should have been returned to Jordan, and you would resolve that problem. But it wasn't. Israel kept held on to the West Bank, which some people think was a huge, huge mistake, because the settlers came in. And now you have the conflict between the Israeli settlers and the native population of the West Bank. So again, Jim, this is what happens when you have nation states who try to what they think is the right thing by the majority for the majority of their citizens, but the minority citizens, in this case the Palestinians, they feel they've been treated like second class citizens, and that's why you have the conflict. And if the goal of Hamas, which is stated quite openly in their charter, is to destroy the state of Israel as a Jewish state, then you have a real big conflict going on. Because if one group of people want to destroy you, how do you have negotiations to have a peaceful resolution? And that's where I think we are now, is how do you get out of this intractable situation that's been going on for decades?
So my impression is that, it's not my impression, I don't know the exact date, but about 2005 or 2006, Israel basically got out of Gaza permanently,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then the people, the citizens of Gaza, the Palestinians, they elected the Hamas government, and they haven't had an election since, from what I understand. So if that's the case, so that means that they've been out of there for like 15, 17 years.
Yeah.
And, so the Palestinians, based on Hamas, who run the place, who have been given go ahead of their citizens to legislate, they basically haven't really done anything with the place, have they? I mean, does that satisfy their demands? Is that what you I don't really know. Not a loaded question. I don't know the answer.
No, I don't think so at all. I think from what we've read is that the United Israel has had a pretty severe economic control over Gaza of what goes in and what goes out. And so when you're living in an area where another nation has a huge impact on the economic activity of that nation or that region or whatever you want to call the Gaza, people are not going to be living to their full potential in terms of standard of living. And that's been one of I think, the concerns of Gaza, to say the least, is that they're not living in the way that they could be because of the economic controls. And this, again, goes back to the whole concept of economic control, is that it hurts the people that are living under those controls. We had wage price controls 50 years ago, and the economy started reeling under Nixon because of that. We had oil controls and capital controls under Jimmy Carter, and the economy did very poorly. We had back-to-back recessions in the late 70s, early 80s. So
why did people at that time think that was a good idea? I mean, now it seems lunacy, but what was the thinking at that time?
It was political. I mean, you were going into an election year in 1972, and inflation was accelerating in 71. And Nixon said, we're going to do wage price controls as a temporary measure in order to dampen the rate of inflation. And, of course, what they did was Arthur Burns, chairman of the Fed, ginned up the money supply. So you had a booming economy in 72, and inflation was starting to bubble up, even though we had wage price controls. And then in October 73, you had the war and oil prices quadrupled. And so it was a total disaster. The stagflation of the 70s has its genesis in obviously the Great Society programs, Vietnam, and Nixon's wage price controls, and the boost in the money supply in the early 70s. So again, governments, as a young person back then, and not being well-versed in economics, but reading as much as I can, it just shows you that governments cannot manage an economy, that you need free markets, where the law of supply and demand allocates resources instead of the government trying to micromanage the economy. And that's, I think, the primary lesson of economics, at least it should be. And that's why economists should speak up against these controls, because they're counterproductive. They don't achieve their goals. I think we're seeing it right now, Jim. I just saw something in the paper today that a Swedish company is bailing out of the wind farms off the coast of New Jersey because they're uneconomical.
Yeah, I see that too.
Electric vehicle sales are plunging, and the dealers inventories are building up like crazy. Ford has lost $3 billion on its EV sales. You cannot run a company with $3 billion of of losses. But what's doing well are the gasoline cars, the F-150 and the other cars. So again, here's another example of the government trying to manage the automobile sector, and it's been a total disaster.
I'm going to quote something else out of one of your recent Substack columns, too. You're talking about Franz Oppenheimer's The State, and he said there are only two ways for men to acquire wealth. The first method is by producing a good or service and voluntarily exchanging that good for the product of somebody else. This is the method of the exchange, the free market, and it's not a zero-sum game. Okay, so the reason I brought that up is because my impression is that especially liberal fiscal policy, the one thing that I think the public doesn't understand more than anything else is the fact that capitalism is not a zero-sum game. I think everybody seems to think there's one static pile of money, and if somebody gets more of it, someone else gets less. Can you explain this concept? Well, because
in fact, November 4th, this coming Saturday, Jim, I'll be speaking at Fort Myers at a seminar of the Mises Institute, and I'll be laying this out of how a free market economy works.
I was going to bring that up at the end, yeah. So, yes, you want to talk about this? You're going to be in Fort Myers on November 4th, right?
Yeah, at 11 o'clock, the seminar begins in downtown Fort Myers. You can go to the Mises.org website, and if you're in the area, you can sign up. There's a slight fee for the seminar that includes a catered lunch, and I'll be talking about how the economy has evolved and where I think it's going over the next several years. And it's very simple, Jim. In order for people to consume, you first have to produce something, whether it's a product or a service. So the example I used to give to my students, and which they understood, is because it's common sense. In order for me as a college professor to be a consumer, I first had to produce something, which is what? Finance, teaching finance courses. So yeah. I can't consume unless I first produce something. In my case, it was teaching finance courses. In your case, it's being a media entrepreneur. Or having a bakery, or having a restaurant, or having a shoe store, or anything like that, or having a big box store, or a mom and pop store on Main Street. So you have to first provide something for the people and which you get money for, and then you take that money and then buy things that you want. That is the way of the free market, of the unhampered market, of the free enterprise system of capitalism. And it works wonderfully because look at all the things available to us in the store and online. You can buy anything. You can buy cars online today through all these different outfits. And I sold my car online before we moved down here because we didn't need two cars. Uh-huh. So we now have an incredible ability to buy goods and services, not only domestically, but internationally. And the amazing thing is with Amazon, and I know some people don't like Amazon, but Amazon, think about this. We've ordered things in late afternoon and early evening, and they've been delivered the next day.
Oh, I get stuff in 2 hours. I don't know. It's unbelievable. It's freaking unbelievable.
In the old days, when you used to call an 800 number when you saw something on TV or out of a catalog, it would take you a week, 10 days, 2 weeks to get
it. That's right.
It's really remarkable. And of course, now you can do subscribe and save. You can order things that you consume on a regular basis every week, every month, every 2 months. And it comes like clockwork. The other day, we had several things from Amazon that I'm subscribe and save. So we have an incredible infrastructure of commerce in the United States, not only domestically, but internationally. We've ordered goods from overseas and they'd come in a few days. People are buying stuff from India, from China, from Japan, Korea, Philippines, Vietnam. I mean, it's just amazing how the world has shrunk in terms of the ability to buy stuff. When years ago, it took a lot of effort to buy things overseas and even domestically. And today it's a seamless process. And so we are the beneficiaries of this high-tech world that we live in. And it's only going to get better, I think, as time goes on. I don't know that much about artificial intelligence, how that will impact our lives. But there are people who are doing work in that area. And years ago, I used to have the idea that you'd have something attached to your head at night and you'd be able to learn a language overnight. I mean, maybe something like that will happen. I'd love to learn several languages seamlessly, but it takes a lot of work to learn a language.
We're close to that, though.
What?
We're close to that.
I think we're getting there. I think what the work that they're doing in neuroscience is exciting, especially to treat mental health issues that people have today. And so you have to be optimistic about the future of America, which is the last quote I have in my presentation from Warren Buffett about not selling America short, because we've gone through wars, depressions, assassinations, and here we are in 2023, and the economy could be a lot better if we didn't have all this spending and money printing and regulation that's been thrown at the private sector for decades. And that's what I've been working on with my Substack column and other people as well, is to sound the alarm and provide solutions. And so I wrote about the Middle East with a solution to how we deal with what seems to be an intractable problem that has been going on for 75 years. And if they don't resolve the property rights issue, which is another key element of the free enterprise system, well-established property rights. You own what you own, I own what I own, and if we want to make a transaction, we exchange goods and services and money, and that's property rights. We exchange the property right to our things that we produce or our services for money.
Murray,
and that's why we have contracts.
You and I have talked many times about basically the evils of communism. You're an immigrant. I'm a first-generation American. My parents were immigrants, and the one thing, the big, huge flaw in communism that Marx does not address, it's the giant hole in the whole thing, is the natural right of possession. Even babies know what they own. Babies know that sucker is mine, you know?
Yeah.
And the things like you said, you're talking about property rights. You can't avoid this. It's a natural human thing. People know what they own, you know? And you can't just turn around and say, well, the state owns it now. And the Albanian government destroyed my family, which was quite wealthy. You know, so I mean, I have first hand knowledge of this. But I mean, I bring that up because you're absolutely right. The property right thing is huge, and basically communism, socialism basically try to just paper it over. Like, it does, well, it's not that important.
Well, the other thing is fascism, which is all part of this, the concept of statism, where the state really decides what you can do, what you cannot do, what you can own, what you cannot own, what you can consume, what you can't consume, what transactions are legal, what transactions are illegal. And so this all gets sorted out in the free market. And sometimes the transactions are not to what some people like, but then you don't have to participate in them. I'm talking about the so-called victimless crimes that we have in the United States. And this is why culture and morality are important in transactions. And as I wrote in my piece, is the Ten Commandments is something that people pay lip service to, I'm afraid. Even people who are church going or synagogue going, we have a Judeo-Christian culture, supposedly, but yet it's constantly violated, especially by the political class, with taxes and spending and war, which is nothing more than legalized murder, as far as I'm concerned. Because in a civilized society, you settle your disputes peacefully as best you can. And war is just an example of how the nation state uses massive aggression to achieve the objectives of the political class, not the people.
Yes.
I mean, do Americans have something against the Russian people? I don't think so.
No.
This is all geopolitics, and it's all about the insider game of the people at the top who make decisions, which cause the deaths of tens of thousands. And I just read recently, I think 100,000 Ukrainians have died in the conflict.
Yes, that's correct. Right.
So you think Zelensky would say, we can't afford to do this anymore. But as long as Biden wants to shovel more aid into Ukraine, and the corruption is off the charts, it's one of the most corrupt places on earth.
Still, that's right. Very, very important to point that out. Zelensky
and Putin have to get together and settle their differences. The same thing as you have in the Mideast. They've got to get together in a neutral place and say, how are we going to resolve this so we can go and have normal trade relations with each other? And we both can benefit from it.
Murray, let me run a theory by you. I'd say that, like, before the 20th century, 19 and before that, most wars, if not all wars, were basically fought over resources. Basically, yeah. One party had something the other party either needed or wanted, and they went to get it, right? Okay, whether it's water power or whatever, or land or whatever it is. Now, especially in the 21st century and probably going back to at least the middle of the 20th century, now we're fighting wars just plain based on hate and nothing else. Do you agree with that?
Well, there's some evidence that we went into Iraq because of resources. There's some evidence of that.
Yeah, right. That's true. You're right.
Yeah.
And I so, never thought of a good example. Yeah.
There is this insatiable appetite by people at the top with their supporters in business who want to use the government to achieve their goals. And this has been going on for ages. We can go back to the beginning of the Republic in the United States, where the crony capitalists were going to Washington with their allies and using subsidies, grants to get the benefits they otherwise would not get in the free market. And we're seeing this with the so-called green energy. The subsidies that are taking place are over the top, and it's just a waste of resources. Remember 40 years ago, Jim, DeLorean set up shop in Ireland, and he got, I think, $150 million either loan or some sort of benefit from the Irish government. I remember reading this in the Wall Street Journal like it was
yesterday.
That was
a lot of money back then, too.
Yes. And I said, this is not going to work out well. Government subsidies for an auto company. And, of course, not too many years later, he went bankrupt.
Yeah.
So, again, the free market allocates resources better than the bureaucrats ever possibly can. And that's the lesson of not only economic theory, but economic history. And if we don't understand theory and history, the politicians are going to keep on making the same mistake over and over again.
Murray, is that the problem when people can't realize the win-win nature of capitalism?
Yeah.
This actually boggles my mind. There's a whole half of the populace in America, if not more, that don't understand the win-win nature. Like you pointed out in your Substack column, it's a win-win thing. You're trading with somebody, you get more money, they get your goods, everybody wins, right? Okay.
That's it. That's it. I mean, it's so simple. The problem is
Yes.
you have this entitlement mentality. So you have a big welfare state. Then you have this notion that the United States has to be, quote, the leader of the free world and protect democracy all over the place. And so you have this warfare state. So you have this welfare warfare state, which is incredibly expensive, incredibly destructive, and it leads to financial crises. We've had governments after governments collapse after World War I and World War II because of all the spending they did for the war. Just go, we can Google a list of all the countries that have had financial crises after World War I. The most famous one is the German hyperinflation of the early 1920s,
Yeah.
which ushered in Hitler 10 years later.
Right.
So again, and the same thing in China after World War II, it ushered in Mao Zedong and the communists taking over
Yeah.
China because of the hyperinflation in China after World War II. So there are huge examples, widespread examples of war leading to financial crisis, leading to totalitarianism. So why people are blind to this is beyond the pale because the evidence is there. It's right in front of your eyes. And to ignore it just shows you that people are not clear thinkers or they're basically spokespersons for the welfare warfare state.
And that hopefully, Murray, you can talk them out of this. I
Well,
can't.
I'm doing
I
the
can
best
only.
I can, Jim. I'm doing the
Yeah.
best I can.
All right.
That's why people have these Substack columns that with tens of thousands of readers, 100,000 readers, if I can get to that point,
Yeah.
then you could have an impact.
Yeah. And also, that's also a capitalist thing because you used to have to write for a newspaper and now you
Yeah.
don't have to anymore. I mean, somebody, I gotta admit, I envy the guys who started that because that's a really, really good idea, you
It's
know?
probably one of the greatest innovations in journalism, if you will, because
Sure.
if you write for a Substack column, you're an effect of journalism, whether it's your opinion, which is what people do in the major newspapers, the Washington Times, Washington Post, Washington Times, New York Times, the Post. They're opinion writers. So instead of having a newspaper as your venue, you have the internet as your venue. So what could be any better than that? And you can earn a few dollars if people support you financially on a
Yeah,
voluntary basis.
I know. It's a fantastic idea. Let's close with this, Murray. So tell me, I did watch Chairman Powell's meeting or press conference that just we're taping this on about 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Wednesday, and it was about 2 hours ago, maybe. So
Yeah.
they did not raise rates, and but all right. What was I going to say? Do you know? No, you don't know. Hold on. Okay. So, but they're not going to raise rates. But he said that the economy is, he called it basically resilient, but they still have a long way to go. I've been talking to you now for about 2, 3 years. I'm under the impression you would probably say there's as much of the problem as the solution, huh? I don't
Well,
know.
there's no question about it. In fact, if people go to my Substack column, I link to the piece I wrote 2 years ago in Fortune magazine where I said the recession should begin by no later than the end of 2023. And if it doesn't come about, we're certainly going to have one in 2024. And that's what I'm hearing from the talking heads on the business shows.
I
And
am
I
too. Yeah.
predicted this 2 years ago because I
Right.
saw the economy evolving because of all the cheap money and low interest rates, that eventually you're going to get a readjustment, which is what a recession is all about, to quote, sustainable economic activity. And unfortunately, when we go into a recession, the Fed steps in and pumps more money into the system, lowers interest rates, so we're back to another cycle. And that's why we keep on having these cycles, because the Fed thinks it can micromanage the economy by with low interest rates and then raising interest rates to stop the inflation that they caused in the first place. So it's a lose-lose situation for the people because prices go up, then they're hit with a recession. They may lose their businesses, may lose their jobs. So what we need is a hands-off policy. That's what laissez-faire means. A hands-off policy from the people who think they know how to manage the economy. And the economy cannot be managed from the top. It has to be dealt with people all over the country, to use a term from a long time ago, doing their own thing in terms of getting goods and services to the consumer.
So I'm back to the original question I did when we started this whole thing. So Powell says, and a lot of other people are saying too, you probably heard this, that the labor market is, quote, really resilient. And then I hear the underlying figures about the fact that right now a full one quarter of the people being hired are being hired by the federal government, by the bureaucracy. So now, I don't know how you measure this, but I would say, relatively speaking, those people aren't producers, you know?
No, not at all. They don't produce anything that the public wants. I mean, the producers are the people that you have in the big box stores, the mom and pop shops, the factories that are producing goods and services, all the way from equipment to consumer goods. Those are the real producers in our society, or providing services at the local level or online. Those are the things that make the economy hum in terms of things that people want, not hiring another bureaucrat at City Hall or hiring another person at the state house or in Washington, D.C. They don't provide any services that the public wants because they're basically pushing paper. Now, obviously, police protection is important. Sanitation is important. These are education services are important, but we can deal with that in a free market as well. But things that the government does usually doesn't add any net value to the American people. It basically withdraws value because you have to support people who work for government who don't produce anything of value.
So close with a little prediction on your part here. First of all, you're absolutely right. I've heard the same thing from a whole bunch of other talking heads too, that everyone says that this coming year we're going to have a major recession. That seems to be kind of like a given almost at this point. But you were talking about the interest rate right now being about 5%. If it goes up to 8% when it comes to the national debt, the debt of the United States, are we screwed?
Yeah, this is, I think, that's worrying a lot of these hedge fund managers and investment analysts who've been around for 30, 40 years, as I have, analyzing the economy. And we're reaching the point now where we may become, as one analyst recently wrote, we may be becoming Argentina, where they ran huge deficits. The central bank printed money to buy up the debt, and then you're off to the races with inflation. And that's what could be happening, probably will be happening down the road. How long that takes, I don't know, but I have some thoughts about it that I'll be presenting in Fort Myers on Saturday, November 4th.
By the way, Murray, I seriously considered coming to that conference. Unfortunately, I can't do it. I can't get away. But I really did. I was thinking about coming down. So anybody out, listen to this, if you, we'll post the information on our blog or a link to it at least to the Mises website. And you guys have fun there, because I'm sorry I'm going to miss it.
I'm sorry you couldn't make it, Jim. It's going to be a great session with three other economists, and a lot of, I think, good information will be available to the attendees.
Yeah, yeah. Murray, I can't thank you enough. You know that.
I appreciate it, Jim.
Oh, yeah. Well, and you have a good time down there. It is down, right?
Well, for me, it's north. I have to drive north to get
there. Okay, I get the geography of Florida constantly confused. So sorry about that. So anyway,
that's okay.
But we'll talk to you soon. I really appreciate you. We need people like you to illuminate the public. That's all to enlighten them. Because like we were saying, I mean, half the public is in the economic Netherlands. So, I don't know. That's, if I can do anything here, it's like give you a platform. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate it.
You take care. All right. We'll see you. Okay. Our thanks to Murray Sabre. I had to push a button there. A lot of buttons to push. Maybe someday I'll have a director. Maybe not. I don't know. So, yeah, our thanks to Murray Sabre. Always a lightning conversation. And, yeah, we need people like him, because I'm astonished at how economically illiterate most Americans are. We're the most capitalist country in the world, and we don't even teach basic economics in high school. It's bullshit. And there's a reason for that, too, and that is because the two parties disagree on the basic premises of the whole thing. The only problem is, and I've said, I don't like to bash liberals per se, just for being liberals, because both parties and historically have served very useful functions. But when it comes to economics, the Democratic Party is just plain wrong. That was one of the primary reasons I became conservative, is I finally realized that. And I know that if you've read the book Freakonomics, I can't remember those two guys' names who wrote that. In the first chapter, they talk about the fact, I think it's New York University, did a poll of economists, and they found out that the more formal education you have in economics, the more likely you were to be conservative. It was a straight 45 degree graph. There's just no. I studied economics, and at some point, you just have to come to the conclusion that liberal fiscal policy is bullshit. That's all there is to it. Now, while that interview was running, and of course I was there, so I know what happened. I got myself a cupcake. I got two, actually. I didn't open this one. So I don't know if you guys know this, but about 15 years ago, the Hostess company was sold to another company. And they promptly changed the recipes of most of the favorite items, especially the chocolate cupcakes and the Twinkies. And the sales plummeted because they sucked. Now, I don't know about you, but I have fond memories of Twinkies and cupcakes when I was growing up. And I always thought the Hostess cupcake was pretty much the perfect food. Even my wife will tell you I'm just eating chemicals. Now, all right, so I don't know if they sold the company again or somebody there got a clue, but they did finally change the recipes more or less back. Especially the Twinkies are pretty much exactly what they were before. The cupcakes, I still don't think, they're still a little on the dry side for me, so I'm just giving you a heads up here. So what I found out is that Walmart, their store cupcakes, which are these, which are really quite cheap. I mean, well, now Bidenomics, but you can buy a dozen of them for less than $5. And they taste pretty much like the way the old Hostess cupcakes used to taste. And so if I have crap on my teeth, that's the reason. All right. So anyway, thanks to Murray. And we'll put his stuff on. We're going to put a link to his Substack blog and a link to his upcoming conference this weekend on our website. It'll be up by tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon, excuse me. So I'm just going to very quickly talk about what he's going to touch on for part three here. And that is, I thought you'd want to know this, because this is really important. Goldie Hawn says that 50 years ago she was abducted by aliens. So I just thought you'd want to know. And that kind of ties into, I've been reading a book the last few days called Dark White by a guy named Jim Schnabel, who's an investigative reporter. He's written quite a few, mostly scientific subjects. He wrote a book about quantum physics, and he kind of, to dumb it down. But he spent like 2 or 3 years researching this book about the entire, both the history and contemporary goings-on of the UFO phenomenon and culture. And it's really an interesting book, and this may surprise you coming from me, but I do want to tell you, I mean, I've constantly, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm disclaiming myself in the sense that I've always told you, and I've always known this, that the UFOs themselves as flying machines are real. And like I said, the reason I know that is because there's a shitload of government documents going back 60, 70 years that talk about this. That's the reason I know. It wasn't a feeling, wasn't a belief, and there's cold, hard evidence. You know, I've said this before, there's no real evidence that they ever talk about extraterrestrials, except for one exception, and that is there's a FBI memo that's on the FBI website where the memo basically says, we're out in the field here, and I can't remember where they were, in New Mexico or something like that. We've got this crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft and three dead aliens. What do you want us to do with them? It was back to the head office. That's the only memo I know of that actually talks about aliens. The other ones just talk about the flying machines, that they were real. So Schnabel basically spent a whole bunch of time, 2-3 years, researching this phenomenon, especially talked about the aliens abductions. And his conclusion was, and which has kind of been my conclusion too, because I've always caveat to all this discussion, There's a kernel of truth. His conclusion was there's a kernel of truth of it, but in it, but the majority of it is bullshit. And he's right about that. The majority of it is bullshit. He talks about meeting people who have been, say they've been abducted. He has had a long, lengthy interview with Bud Hopkins, who's a guy who actually treated and hypnotized people who say they were abducted. Him and David Jacobs have been probably the two major people in that field. David Jacobs is still alive, but Hopkins isn't. Although I think Jacobs is like 88 years old or something now. He's retired, but he's still alive. And Jacobs, if you're interested, his name's David Jacobs. You can look up on Amazon. He's written two or three books where he basically says that his conclusion after interviewing and hypnotizing hundreds of people who say they've been abducted is that the aliens are basically trying to create a hybrid race between us and them. And he's quite convinced of this. And the thing is, and Schnabel does acknowledge this, the little physical evidence that there exists does seem to point to the fact this phenomenon is real. But Schnabel came to the conclusion the vast majority of the people who say they've been abducted are basically nuts. That's his conclusion. So, and it flies in the face of what Jacobs and Hopkins concluded. But it's, you know, his book's very compelling. And my guess is he's right. You know, he still acknowledges the fact that something's going on. But yeah, the vast majority of people who claim they've been abducted are probably full of shit. Not all of them, most of them. He talks about too, and this is really always fascinated me. If you want to read an interesting book, there's the Mothman Prophecies by a guy named John Keel. It was written, I think, in 61 or 62. And it was based, the movie by Richard Gere from the 1980s is based on the book. And the thing is so what happened is that in Point Pleasant, Ohio, is it? I got that right? People started seeing this giant winged humanoid creature flying around town. Quite a few people said they saw it. And along with that, they started to get visits by what are contemporarily called the Men in Black. And that is, he called them in the book, Q called them unmen. Because they were barely human looking. They looked really weird. Yeah, they walked and talked and stuff like that. But he said they looked very odd. And that was also contrasted with the real FBI agents that showed up in town and started interviewing people. And so they're just normal guys, but they started talking to people too. And the weird thing is, Keel points this out, and apparently this was very true. There were so many of these unmen, these weird men in black walking around town, that basically the whole town saw them. It was on a regular basis over the course of a year. They walked into the newspaper office. They walked into people's offices and talked to them. And they were just very, very weird. Not even creepy, just weird looking, you know? So it's, you know, Schnabel acknowledges the fact that Keel's conclusion is very interesting. Keel came to the conclusion that this had nothing to do with UFOs, but he said it had to do with some sort of external high intelligence, which he could not pin down. But he said that it was like somebody was pulling a prank on us. He said it was like somebody was fucking with us, frankly, and he didn't know if it had anything to do with UFOs or not. But he said there's some external manipulating intelligence going on here, because he said all sorts of weird things happen constantly, and to him too. When he started going to, when he went to the town to start investigating shit, he said all sorts of weird shit broke out. Like you get phone calls, radios would broadcast information spontaneously even if they weren't plugged in. It's just weird stuff, you know. And Schnabel believed him because, the guy was really credible. He was extremely credible, and he went through great pains to do this objectively. And it was just a very, very strange situation. You know, who knows what the hell's going on, you know? My general theory of life, I've come to this conclusion, maybe it's because of reading all this sort of stuff, I think there's something going on here, and when I mean here, on Earth and in our universe, that we as humans are completely and totally unaware of. That's what I think. There's something going on here, and we are, it's beyond our senses. We can't sense it. That's what I think, but that's my two bits. And with that, I'm going to go to bed. So tomorrow night, David Strom is joining us. That we're going to pre-tape that interview in the afternoon too, even though he has been in Minneapolis here. But we're going to pre-tape it anyway to make it convenient for him. And I'll take your phone calls tomorrow night if you want. And yeah, and we're gonna have a really nice nap. That's what we're gonna do. Good night, Esperanza. Good night, Uncle Donnie. And good night to you, wherever you are. We'll see you tomorrow.